I'm scared to death. Hi, Gordy. How you doing? All right. Now I'm better. Okay. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict and many other things. I drove 3 hours to get here because they asked me if I'd speak at an AA meeting. My God has this incredible sense of humor. Jeez. And what's worse is I was so inspired to wear a dress. Most of my family's never seen me in a dress. They haven't even seen that I got legs. So this is a first all the way around, and I'm really happy to be here. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad is still actively drinking. My mother died a pill addict, and I became both. And I became a codependent and, just all of it. I was the oldest of three children. I have a sister 5 years younger who is recovering in Al-Anon. I have a brother who's 8 years younger who's recovering in AA. But my dad's not alcoholic. He still suffers with this illness and feels like we all ran away from him because he's still the drunk. He doesn't have to go to meetings. We got to be alcoholics and we got to go to meetings. So that kind of... I really feel uncomfortable behind this thing. This is awful. Snap the bugger off. Wait a minute. Take that first. He's already giving me ugly looks. Okay. Well, I got a dress with big pockets, and I can do that. Okay. I grew up in a small town, very small, and it's Robesonia, not Robesonia. Whoever said that. And there was all kinds of alcoholism in my family. Both my grandfathers were, but the ones that impacted on me the most, I believe, was my father's. I didn't know my mother was an addict until years after her death, and then it started to fall into place. Hers were the first pills that I stole when I was about 19. But she was so sick with her codependency that it took me years to figure out that she was an addict as well. So I grew up with all kinds of screwed up messages about myself, and I was a tomboy, and I was active in sports. I remember I was 6 years old, and I was playing softball for playground team, and when I got into first grade, they had show and tell. You know, you take your stuff and show it. And all my friends are carrying their dolls, and my dad made a point of pointing out that I carried my Robin Roberts baseball glove and my bat, you know. And that was wonderful because I always loved sports. I was good at sports, and it came naturally, and I got a lot of goodies from the people around me because of my athletic ability, except for my dad. I got real warped messages about what it took to be a woman, and I wasn't one unless I let him beat me at basketball, and I let that happen once, and I never let that happen again. That wasn't any fun at all, and it wasn't worth it. I didn't like the prize either, I'll tell you. So it was okay to drink at my house, and we got to do that on holidays. We got cordials, which were tiny little glasses with tiny little colored wines in, and as soon as they turned their backs, I hit the beer tap, you know. And by the time I was 16 and got my license, it was like a ticket to ride. I was gone. Eagle Hotel in Burnville, and geez. They invited me to every party in high school, no matter what the peer group was. I majored in art, so I got to have classes with everybody. I had some with the academic kids and some with the commercial kids, and whenever they had a party, they invited me. I had to bring the booze, but that was okay, because everybody had to bring something, and it just didn't, you know, seem fair. And I was in 10th grade, and in the high school play, we did The Sound of Music. And from the time I left my house till I got to the high school, which was about 2 miles away, I drank about a pint of Southern Comfort, and I also played a nun. And I get up on that stage, and the hills were alive with the sound of music. It was wonderful. Nobody knew what I would do when I got there, which made perfect sense because I never knew what I would do when I got there. And that was about what my high school years were like. I graduated class clown. I got an A in art, big deal, you know. And they turned me loose on the world. And another significant thing happened about 16. I had the first of a series of now 9 knee operations. I've got these rickety knees. Well, see, I'm just not coordinated at all. I'm a klutz, and I was this athlete, and I kept wrecking my knees. And I learned something very early in my injury career, and that is pain pills. They don't smell. You don't throw up on your feet. And you feel good all day long, whether you have pain or not. It was wonderful. So I wrecked one knee, and 3 months later I wrecked the other knee, and then I graduated from high school and I went to work at the hospital where the doctors were that fixed the knees. It was divine, you know? And if you've ever dealt with a hospital clinic, you know that you can go there every day for a year and not run into the same doctor. Well, working there, I knew who was there on Tuesdays, and boy, I mean, when I think of how I calculated to get the prescriptions filled and the shots so that I never ran into the same doctor, I mean, I had no idea I had such mental capabilities. I just kept it all in order, you know. Keen intellectual alcoholic mind, a friend of mine says. I love that. So I was well on my way. By 18, I was doing pills all day long and drinking at nighttime. And I loved my job at the hospital. I got to take patients back and forth from physical therapy, and most of them were in traction because of doing what I was doing. They just had a tougher landing than I did up until that point, you know. So I got along well with everybody. And about 3 years into that job, although I loved it, I decided I needed to do something. I needed to have a career. I needed to be something. Because what I was never enough. I was good in sports, but that wasn't what I needed to be good in. And my dad and I never got along. We never got along. The only time we were really close was when I could drink him and his buddies under the table. And then I was fun to have around, you know. He'd take me with him to the vets, and he'd bet $50. I said, watch what she can do. Southern Comfort. Down a hatch. And, you know, I really felt like I was something when I was with him. Because I did all that. I felt, you know, it really got sad because when I got sober, we really didn't have a damn thing to talk about anymore. You know, well, I didn't particularly care that he remembered every fart and thing I did from the time I was 4. And he never had any problem telling people. He was a barber by trade. He still is, by damned. And everything that happened to me growing up was public knowledge through the barbershop, whether it was menstruation or masturbation, the whole damn world. And I remember being terrified about such things and talking to my mother about it, which is what I understood daughters and mothers did, and having her absolute attention and understanding, and then hearing my old man laugh about it in the barbershop, I wanted to kill him. Most of my life I wanted to kill him. He did things to me that he's still too sick to know about. And sometimes I'm still real angry about that. He's too ill to know how much he hurt me over the years. And I work real hard in other programs to just be okay with all that and let him be ill. But the thing that I decided to do to get everybody's attention and my father's unconditional love and pride was to become a nurse. I had visions of me in a white uniform. And when I made that decision, even though I liked my job, it was like, damn, if it fixes, don't break it or work it or whatever the hell, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I like my job, but I needed to be something else. What I was wasn't enough. So I went to nursing school. But before I went, my mom threw this party for me, and it was a wing-dang boogie, I'll tell you. Everybody that I knew and loved came. And it was another one of these deals where my mom said, your father and I are proud of you. Your father and I? I never heard it from him. My father and I, oh, what is my father? My father cuts hair, and he does weird things in the barbershop, you know? What about my father and I? So, I mean, the doctors that I worked with were there, and the people in physical therapy, and the nurses that I drank with were there. It was wonderful, and I knew by that celebration that the uniform was it. Sorry. It's hard to stand still. So off I went to nursing school. Now, you have to know that I didn't know a damn thing about nursing. I hardly knew anything about studying. I mean, don't take nothing to study art. It didn't take a whole lot to study drinking. And I got into nursing school on a paper I wrote why I wanted to be a nurse. I had all the right reasons, you know. My heart was in the right place. I got along well with people, and bullshit goes forever, you know. So I got into nursing school, and I walked off the elevator. I was 21 years old, which was the key, and I didn't know it then. I was 21 years old, and I'm there with all these 18-year-old snot brats that had chemistry and algebra 1 and 2, and, I mean, they're there for a reason, and it was different than mine, you know. And within a matter of weeks, months, I knew that I was in big trouble, academically, spiritually, emotionally, physically, you name it. I'm stealing my mother's diet pills, I'm taking Darvon in case I have pain, and I'm 21 years old, so I don't have to put up with any of the crap that the other freshmen are putting up with. I don't have to scrub floors with toothbrushes. I just need to bring the booze, and I knew how to do that. So I brought the booze. We had this system. I'd call on the telephone. They'd open the fire exit. We'd get 5 cases of beer up 6 flights of steps before the house mother knew the fire door was open. We were good, you know? But with the diet pills, that just added the zest to my day. I mean, I'm there studying, and, you know, anybody that ever used amphetamines, you know that you're doing it 90 miles an hour, whatever it is, you know? And I'm flying. I'm writing outlines, and I'm ironing my uniforms, and I'm studying, and I'm doing tests, and I'm cleaning my room, and a little bit of sex on the side, and everything's going, you know? So I wake up in the morning for this exam, and I open the book, and I'm looking, and I thought, it's right, what happened? I must be learning something because I'm working so hard, you know what I mean? But there wasn't anything up here. There wasn't anything up here, nothing. And I'd sit down for an exam, and blank, nothing. So about a week before capping, I got a letter in my mailbox that said, I flunked an exam. I needed to be out of the building by noon the next day. And it was like, whew. There went the vision. There went the white uniform. There went the screwing around on the side. And how much of this was my parents going to find out about? And did I really flunk a test because there was nobody there that could show it to me? The professor said the test was in the office that I flunked, and of course the office was locked because it was a weekend, and Sister Mary Holycard had the key, and she was in Massachusetts, and so I didn't know what I got caught at, or if I really did flunk, or I really didn't know, and I was too ashamed, scared, embarrassed, and dead inside to ask. I knew that the jig was up, and I went back to my hometown. An absolute failure at 21. And I knew that I had turned into everything my father always said I would be. And I was devastated. And I went home and I drank and I drugged and I went to the fire company and I fell off the bar stools and I was looking for love in all the wrong places and most of them were as drunk as I was. And I would come home barely making it up the steps, and my mother would yank me to the family doctor. She's having an emotional breakdown. So they gave me new drugs. And I couldn't sleep at night, so they told me to drink a little whiskey with my new drugs. And in the course of the next, 14 years or so, I was on Elavil and Melaril and Stelazine and Librium and Valium and it don't come up, it don't go down. It was terrible. And then when I was really, really sick on the pills and couldn't really, really swallow even any whiskey, then I'd go to the doctor and get shots. And he used to get ticked off if I drive myself. Now this guy held his records together with index cards, clothespins on a shoebox on top of his desk. Cost me $8 a pop. I got 75 milligrams of Tolwyn IM and 30 milligrams of Compazine. And this was on a daily basis for years. And it was after I had 15 Darvon and all the whiskey that my rotten little belly could hold. When I couldn't get any more down, then I'd go up to good old Needles. That was his nickname. I have to watch myself. Oh, good old Doc. And I had such... By the time that siege with him ended, I had welts on the sides of my thighs like half of oranges. They were red and hard and hot, and many times they got abscessed. The pain was excruciating when he'd hit them. Many times he'd hit that lump of the needle, and it would go right back out again. They bled profusely, and he was on my thighs because my arms were done, my cheeks were done. There wasn't any place left to put these shots. And then I go home and eat, because by that time there were only like 2 10-minute periods in a day that I could actually get something in there that stayed. So when I get everything settled down, now I drive from his office to the house, and if I was lucky, I got it all together in the driveway, but sometimes I was asleep before the keys were out of the car. And I'd stand in front of the fridge and I'd look for food, and then I'd go sleep. And I say go because anywhere from the fridge to the bed is where sleeping started, where that occurred. I'm telling you, I laid in the hallway with cheese in my cheek. Sometimes I got as far as the bathroom, but... Anyway, the first 3 years out of nursing school, I ended up in the nut ward twice. And somewhere along, I mean, big time. My father assured me that I was always going to be a failure. And then when I got out of nursing school, I decided I needed something to make me feel better about me. You know, well, if I just had a new, or if I just bought a, or if I just went to, well, I bought a. Bought a 1969 MGB. Beautiful yellow bugger, traded in the best Studebaker in the world on this end. I mean, this Studebaker was a big old square bugger that got 97,000 miles to the gallon, held 8 kids' luggage, and would run forever. It was wonderful. And I bought this MGB. My father said, you can't afford to have a new car. You can't goddamn keep a job. You ain't worth you know this finger. Oh. And the whole time he's going like this, I'm going like this. And I bought it. $75 a month, and they took my Studebaker, you know? And within a month, within 30 days, there wasn't a damn fender on that car that wasn't bookered. I couldn't get by garbage cans, telephone poles, into driveways. And that car felt so much, looked so much like I felt. It was unbelievable. I didn't feel whole. I was lost. I lost myself. I left big pieces at nursing school. My friends were in college or married, and I'm back in this little hick town where everybody knows I screwed up. You know, and if they don't know, just come to the barbershop and Spooker will tell you all about it, you know? Jeez. And he and I would fight, knock down dragouts. My mom never heard of Al-Anon, but she would leave the living room a mess when he just kept trying to tell me what I was doing wrong. And, you know, two drunks telling each other what they're doing wrong don't work. And I knew no limits. There were no limits. Don't push me. Don't touch me. Get out of my face. And he figured because he was a dad, he had rights. But he was a drunk. Just like me, and neither one of us had any rights, and we'd kill each other. And then I'd move in with my Nana. My Nana, 82 years old, still alive, best enabler I ever had. If it wouldn't be for her, I'd probably be dead today. And I never met Jimmy. Jimmy's my honey. So after a couple of trips to the nut ward and then a couple of major hospitalizations, I blacked out a few times behind the steering wheel. One time, I had a neighbor who was always like a grandmother to me, and she was always like a grandma. She was that old when I first met her when I was 4. And I was active, and I saw her almost daily until she died about 10 years ago. And one day I was up at her house, and she had a spice rack in the kitchen by the sink that had all her medicines on it. And I noticed that there was a bottle there that I don't know that I noticed before. And I never took any of her pills because she never had anything that was any good, for one thing. But I noticed this white bottle that did these big white pills that didn't have any label on. I thought, I wonder what they are. So I took one. And somehow I wound up around a telephone pole like 9 miles east on 422. I don't know where the hell I was going. doing? I don't know what I was doing. And they took me to the hospital. They thought I had head injuries because I didn't know where I was. But you know, the insanity of this damn disease, man. They ran tests up one side of me, down the other, found nothing wrong. But that was okay. When I got out, just to make sure it wasn't something that I ate that maybe gave that pill a bad kick, I went and took another one. I mean, damn. That time I never got out of the house, though. I just got dumb in her living room. I don't know what that stuff was. Probably cardiac something. I don't know. It didn't matter. I had a reputation for going through friends' and family's medicine chests. And when I couldn't get the pills I needed, I went to the doctor. And when I couldn't do that, I'd end up in the hospital. Somewhere along there, my addiction created headaches, and I treated them for years. Medically, psychiatrically, you know, it didn't matter. I had 3 or 4 hospitalizations where I allowed them to do a pneumoencephalogram and a myelogram and all that stuff to determine where the headaches are coming from. And I figured, hell, they're either going to find I got a brain tumor the size of Texas and keep me on pain pills, or I'm going to be nuts and they're going to keep giving me all these goofballs forever and I ain't ever going to have to deal with nothing. So I didn't care what kind of pain I had to go through. I was sober about 4 years before I really knew I never had a headache. I never had a headache. Never. And one day I'm talking to somebody about these, somebody that I hadn't seen for years, and they said, well, what happened to your headaches? How are your headaches now that you're not drinking and drugging anymore? And I heard myself telling the old headache story, and I thought, wait a minute. I never had no damn headaches. That's like a miracle right there, spiritual awakening. I ain't never had no damn headaches. So the last time I got out of the nut ward, within a few weeks I met the man that became my husband, Jimmy. Jimmy, his name is. Now, I knew him 9 years earlier because my brother and sister and I used to babysit for his 4 kids. So between Jimmy and his 4 kids and Mitch and Robin and me, we had a team for whatever we were playing. And we played in the park all the time, and it was wonderful. And then I moved away. And 9 years later, I'm working at a little ice cream shop because twirling an ice cream cone was all I was capable of. After 30 days at Wormsville State Hospital, I learned to do the Thorazine shuffle. It was wonderful. Ooh. I'm so damn lucky I'm alive today, it just knocks my socks off. When I hear all this crap, it's phew. So I met Jimmy, and he remembered this cute little kid that lived in the neighborhood, and he was about to be divorced, and he had his kid Sunday afternoon for ice cream, and I could do ice cream, so we started dating. And within a short period of time, we were dating serious, and we were talking about, I was crazier than a loon. I know that during that time, there were different periods when different drugs were more available. I don't know if it was available, but there, you know, I kind of get into a drug pattern. And with this is a constant Southern comfort. I mean, the pills were wake up time till 3 o'clock, and from 5 till pass out was Southern comfort. And that was it. You know, sometimes the concoction of pills varied, but the booze was always the same. 5 o'clock, off the fridge door, because you don't want to water that stuff down with ice, you know what I mean? So I met Jimmy, and we started dating, and he's got these 4 little kids that I used to babysit for who are now teenage girls, and they don't want no parts of me. I was mean. I don't know how. I didn't know why he wanted to spend any time with me, because I was worthless, and I knew that from every area of my life. I knew that I was worthless. I was a failure. I was a screw-up. I couldn't even keep a factory job for more than 3 months at a time. There wasn't anybody even in the local tap rooms that wanted to spend any time with me. Had a terrible reputation. And guilt, and shame, and, you know, can't figure out how you keep doing the same shit over and over and over again, and I did it. And Jimmy and I decided to get married, and we'd been going together about a year and a half or something like that, and it was a beautiful wedding. I know it was beautiful. The pictures are divine. What alcoholic plans a 6 p.m. wedding? You know, you ain't no good come 6 o'clock. It was a dumb move. But I didn't know what was wrong with me. I thought I was nuts. I had this wonderful system that kept telling me, you're emotionally unstable and, you know, mental retard. It was awful. And my parents and my aunts and all the people that loved me had this wonderful justification for my ill behavior. And it was all somebody else's fault, and I bought it hook, line, and sinker. I mean, every pill I ever took came from a doctor, and they must know what the hell they're doing. Alcoholics are known for errors in judgment, and I've made a few errors. So Jimmy and I got married, and his parents, in fact, there was nobody from his family that came to the wedding except the four kids, because by then, I mean, they didn't even know me, but they heard about me. And they were angry at him because in the years we've been together, 16 and a half, I have found out that, they didn't know who I was. They were angry at him for divorcing his first wife, but it came out like it was my fault, and I took that on. But they heard about me, and they didn't want him. I was such a far cry from the first one, they didn't want him dating me, so he stopped going, and oh, did I do numbers on that for years. I thought I took him away from his family. So they wouldn't come to the wedding, and as a matter of fact, we were out of their lives for 15 years, based on my reputation. They never even met me. In the last year, on their 60th wedding anniversary, the two of my husband's sisters invited us back. That was a real gift. This last year has been a very special one, a very rewarding one. And I found myself feeling real sad because of all the lost time and why did we have to lose 15 years? And then I thought, shit, you know, they didn't like me based on my reputation. If they'd have known me. So, God knows what he's doing, see. I believe that my higher power has a program. So me and Jimmy got married, and we were going to have the Brady Bunch. His, mine, ours, picket fences, dogs, all of it. And what we had was screaming and hollering and vomiting and me getting up out of bed in the middle of anything to get sick and... I would fall asleep or pass out at 6 o'clock at night. Jimmy wrote every thank you card from the wedding. I was not capable. I couldn't hold a pen. For years, I couldn't hold a pen, much less make it work. And that was Stelazine, that one. That was a bugger. Phew. On Stelazine, I also sold encyclopedias, too. They put me in a car, drop me in another town and say, sell, you know? Like, I was in the Twilight Zone for years. I'd go to bars and tell them it was my birthday and have fun all night long. They'd buy me a drink, or 20. So me and Jimmy got married, and needless to say, it was not what it was cracked up to be, to say the least. It was very painful for both of us, because I didn't know why I was the way I was. He certainly didn't, and he was feeling pretty much like he'd failed a marriage, and he was real homesick for his kids, and we were just a pitiful pair, I'm telling you. And then one day, the oldest kid, his oldest kid, who had been running the show at her house, decided she needed to come spend some time. Well, actually, Jimmy's ex-wife called and said, will you take her for the weekend? She's really getting to me. And I thought, here's the opportunity, boy. Bring them in. We'll have them. Bring them in. Sure. Come on. Come for the weekend, you know. So she came for the weekend, and we're living by then in a little second-floor walk-up with one bedroom, ours. And we got Christopher, who's just about 4 pounds, 13 ounces, in the bed, in the living room in a crib. And then we get this other oldest kid, Pat. And she came for a weekend and stayed for 6 years. I had long weekends in my addiction, but that one was the pits. I kept calling her mother drunk, saying, the weekend's up. Get her out of here. And then her new husband would call my new husband and say, get that crazy-ass woman off the telephone. Oh, and Jimmy, he was afraid to go to work because I created. So he moved me out on the farm to try and get me out of everybody's way. I didn't know why. What happened that... I loved those kids. I babysat for those kids, and I couldn't figure out what happened. Because I come home from work and I decide that today it's going to be different and I'm going to show them how much I love them, and I really am glad to have them. But you know, between my heart and my mouth stood this thing called addiction, and by the time the words hit my lips, they were foul and demeaning, and I turned into my father all over again. I hated myself. And I hated Jimmy because I didn't know why he loved me, and I hated the kids because I didn't know how to deal with them, and I got this son, Christopher. Phew. I used all through my pregnancy. Scared to death. I didn't know there was a God. I was afraid that, you know, I couldn't wait for the moment that I heard the heartbeat. And I had heard a lot of things about what happens to babies who were born to addicts. But I wasn't an addict. See, I was taking prescription pills. Jimmy would complain about all the whiskey, so I tried to cut down. And I told the baby doctor I was having trouble sleeping, so he said, well, have a little red wine before you go to bed at night. So I bought 4 gallons in case it snowed before October, you know? It just didn't matter. I'm an addict, and I was feeding an illness. And I thought Christopher was going to be the saving grace, and he was just one more person in my life that I didn't know how to deal with. And then one day into this marriage, about 8 years into this marriage, and by that time we had the second daughter with us, and our lives were all incredibly unmanageable. I was as unpredictable as the weather. I was sick all the time. I threw up once a day, given twice if I was having a tough day. And I was really a mess. And then the doctor died. Phew. The guy with a needle croaked. But just before he did, I noticed he was looking a little green around the gills, and he had a bad cough and slump-shouldered. So I had this 6-month refillable prescription for Darvon that I was to get filled 5 times or 6 months, whichever came first. I was getting it filled once a week for years. And that was a piece of work to find a drugstore that would do it with, you know, without a computer to see how much you're taking, how often. I was taking 100 a week. So just before he died, I got a new prescription. Although I still had like 6 weeks on the other one, I told him I was going on vacation. And so he wrote me one, you know. He couldn't keep track of me anymore. He was just grateful if I paid him. So he died. And the next time I went to get this prescription refilled, I walked into the drugstore and the woman filled it, handed her the new prescription. She filled it, gave it to me, and she said, Cass, I think you better find yourself a new doctor because I really think Dr. So-and-so wanted you to have this, but it's against the law to fill a prescription on a dead doctor's signature. I got hysterical in the drugstore. I mean, I'm falling down laughing on my ass. What do you mean? You fill it illegally all these years, now just because a chump died, you can't fill it no more? That was really the beginning of the end for me. I didn't want to hunt down another sleazebag doctor who had cobwebs in his office. I didn't want to track down another pharmacist who didn't give a shit whether I was dead or alive as long as I'd cough up $15.80. And it got harder to keep up an addiction in a relationship. You got to watch who's getting the bills. And I'm stealing money from the places I'm working, and I'm stealing money from family, and I'm still not able to work for very long. People get wind of me when I'm hanging on the furniture, and I can't keep my eyes open, you know. So I went to back to the Nut House where I was introduced to my first psychologist, and he was the first guy that I got honest with. I said, I'm in trouble. I'm afraid that I can't function without Darvon. And I don't know what to do about that. And to make a windy story short, he got me to PAA, Pill Addicts Anonymous, something that's it's same 12 steps, and it's peculiar to my area. I like that word, peculiar. There aren't many of them around, but that was the place for me. That's the first meeting I fell into, and I sat there and cried. They asked me my name, and I couldn't even say my name. I just cried. And from there, I went to detox. I wrote a note to my boss at work, and I got my husband and my mother together, and I said, this is what's up. But I did that after I made a bed date for detox. I was scared to death they were going to try and love this all away again like they tried to do so many times in the past. And I knew in my guts that there wasn't anything they were going to be able to love away. So I got into detox. That was April 19th, 1980. And my life went from miserable to worse. Now I got a 5-year-old son who I don't know how to mother, 2 early 20-year-old daughters who I certainly don't know how to mother, a husband I don't know how to wife, a job that was brainless and I could do without any problems. I was no longer tending bar at the VFW on a Friday night. I was no longer bowling with the women at the fire company on a Wednesday night, and my life sucked. There, I was left with gaping holes in my social calendar. And I really didn't know what to do with me. And I didn't know what the hell I was doing at AA. I was afraid there. I was afraid that somebody, if I told them for a minute that I wanted a drink, they would shackle me to a chair with some 900-pound mama who's going to keep me out of all rooms. I didn't know. I don't know what AA was. And that was the beginning. AA was the very beginning. I got hooked into outpatient counseling, and between AA and PAA and my outpatient counselor, I started to get in touch with gratitude. By hook or by crook, she made me pray. She told me what to say because I didn't know how to pray. I was scared to death of God because of all that I did. I was sure he had no room for me anymore. And that was a mistake. But my early recovery turned into a time of gratitude when I found a power greater than myself and when I practiced prayer. I had to sit and spend time with me in order to find out what I was grateful for. You know what I mean? Because I had such a negative attitude. And the first time she made me pray and made me do a gratitude list, I'm sitting on the end of the bed one morning trying to figure out what the hell I'm grateful for. And it occurred to me that I didn't throw up that morning. And I was grateful for that. But more than that, I was grateful because like 6 weeks went by since I was in detox and I didn't notice that I wasn't throwing up anymore. Whew. So I was really grateful for that. And that started it. So from that point forward, my prayers included every day something new I was grateful for. And I became grateful for knowing that I put my son on the bus and that he was in school. I mean, I did it. For years, at 11 o'clock, I'd notice he wasn't there, but I didn't remember if I put him on the bus, if he had a coat, if he had lunch money. I didn't know. I was grateful to be able to talk to my sponsor and say, you want to go for breakfast before the 11 o'clock meeting? And know pretty well that I was going to be able to do that. I didn't have no day before 4 o'clock, because I didn't know if my guts were going to be back where they belonged, or all my body parts were going to be together, or I took inventory to find out if I had my car and my own clothes, and, you know. So I started to be real grateful. The first year in recovery, do I need to be winding this up? Am I getting... First year in recovery, my mother died. Well, that was the beginning of her death. She died for 14 miserable months. Of cancer, and that was about 7 years ago, I believe. And through the grace of God and these 12-step rooms, I was able to get through that without picking up a drink or a drug. I was also able to carry a message without even knowing it to my sister, who could not figure out how come I could sit still. I ain't never sit still in my life. And we would pray in the morning, and that's something that we never did. And we took care of my mom at home. My dad wanted her out of the house. He was afraid she'd die there. I didn't understand that for years, and it took me a long while till I could appreciate that different people do death differently. But that afternoon, the afternoon that my mom died, I had her at home. She was at home, and it was snowing. It was like December 12th, and we were watching a football game. She was kind of out of it on the sofa. And I got her up, sat her up, and she could see the snow on the television. It was snowing so bad at this football game that you could hardly see the players. And the night before they buried her, it started snowing for real. And my brother flew in from Texas and my uncle from Virginia, and we're walking as a family, you know, glad to see you and not glad under these circumstances. And Through the course of the evening, there were like 20 of us walking in the snow, brothers and sisters and kids, and from 50 years old to 2 years old. And it snowed so deeply, it was just probably the worst blizzard we had in many years. And as the evening wore on, we were talking about how much my mom loved the snow. I mean, if it snowed in our neighborhood, it was because Betty did a snow dance in the big flannel nightie and the snow boots, you know. She was involved in every snowball battle that I was in all my life. She iced up the Rutschie in the back that we use, you know, them aluminum flying saucers. She'd ice that bugger. She was at every skating party we ever had. She threw the first snowball every time I got in trouble with snowball battles. She took us to Weiser Park and had our skating party. She was always involved with us in the snow. And as the evening went on, we were all sharing our own stories about something special we did with Mom in the snow. And what started out to be a really sad occasion turned into be a real joyous one, one of real celebration. And I mean, we were laughing, and we're all laying on West Franklin Street making snow angels, you know, laughing. And the next morning, George Hetrick, the funeral director, called across the street and said, "You better get your trucks out. We can't get her out of the funeral parlor," you know. And all the guys in the neighborhood got the big plows out and these four-wheel drive, and those that didn't have trucks had shovels. We had a shovel mom out of the funeral home. They had a plower into the cemetery, and every friend that was at the funeral stood there and said, "How else would she go?" You know, the biggest snowstorm of the year, and it was wonderful. That was the biggest period of gratitude I have ever experienced in recovery, because I learned that between me and God and AA, there isn't anything that goes down the pipe that I have to drink over again. And I've held that a day at a time for the last 7 years or so. I started going to college. My counselor asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I didn't know. And I'm going. I'm doing Espanol. This little Pennsylvania Dutch broad got to learn Spanish. But I'm doing it. God's really carrying this one. I'm barely. This is tough. 8.5 years I'm going to college, and I started that because my counselor said you need to look about what makes you happy and what you need to do to fill your life. So that started, and that's been a day at a time and a course at a time, and I may graduate before my grandsons get to college, but I don't know, and it doesn't matter. I'm there today. A couple of really beautiful things are in my life today, and that is Jimmy, my hubby of 16 and a half years. And by the way, that marriage has lasted 16 years longer than anybody said it would. Recovery does rub off. He's not an alcoholic. He doesn't go to Al-Anon because, God love him, he doesn't think he's been affected by living with me. Oh, God. Oh. I've got a son who will be 15 on October 6th, if the good Lord lets him live that long. And, you know, I still don't know what to do with him. I mean, I don't know what to do with this. When I was 15, I didn't have such healthy things going on in my life. But, you know, I got friends in AA who say, "I tried this with my kid and this one don't work," you know. Or, "I tried this with my kid and I had pretty good luck." So I've got a wealth of information to help me through this. I've got 3 2/3 grandchildren, and their mothers let them spend time with me. Can you imagine? You know, we have wonderful times together. I got this little granddaughter, Amanda, who says, "Nana." She comes running to me from nowhere. She's just, I got this rabbit, Sam, who somebody gave to me as a prank on my 40th birthday, and he is a love of my life. He's a lop-eared black rabbit who asks nothing of me, but will lick me unconditionally, and it don't matter where I've been or what I've been doing. He don't care if I'm late. He don't care if I cook. He just loves me. And when I'm not there, he poops in the floor because he don't like when I'm not there. I have. People talk about beyond your wildest dreams, and I have had a dream or two. I have had incredible things happen in my life in this program. I idolized Rosemary Clooney, and I kind of fell in love with her all over again when I got into detox and my mom gave me her book.
And I got sober and read this book and read it again, because you know you have to read things 19 times. You can't put two words together and make sentences. And I wrote to her when I was in detox, and I wrote to her every 6 months for years to this address in the book, and I never did get an answer. But I wasn't discouraged until I got a letter back, address unknown. And to make a long story short, the manipulation that comes in recovery is you just learn to fine-tune it a little better, you know? And I ended up writing to her again through Concord Jazz in California, and they wrote a letter to her, and I got a letter back from Rosemary Clooney. And I took it to every AA meeting where everybody said, she's nuts, she's writing to some goddamn movie star, she's crazy, you know? And then I went to see Rosemary Clooney in concert, and I asked if people wanted to go, and they're going, I want to get in a car with her, she's nuts, you know? And see, these people grew up with me, they knew that I was in every nut ward in the state, so they weren't going to get in a car with me, but Rosemary Clooney did write back to me. And a friend of mine in AA called one time on the eve of my 39th birthday and said, come to New York this weekend. My wife and I got tickets. We're going to see Rosemary Clooney. Come on up. I said, okay. And I flew up to New York City. Now, I didn't ever do New York City, drunk or sober, and I was scared to death. Well, actually, I was there once on my senior class trip, but I lost all my money playing strip poker on the bus on the way, and I was shit-faced, so I got there. So that don't count. But I had an opportunity to meet Rosemary Clooney. And I thought it was only right that she should know that such a kook lives, that there's really a person out here that's as nuts about her as I am. And I still write to her, and I believe that someday I'm going to meet her. And that we're going to sit down and have coffee and talk about all the antics. I mean, I've sent her balloons in the box, and I take 8,200 zoom lens pictures, and it's really bizarre. But I have dreams today, and I have hopes today, you know? The last 24 hours of my addiction was worried about, am I going to get it? Am I going to be able to pay for it? Am I going to get caught? Who's going to find out? The insanity of addiction. In 9.5 years, I'd gotten into AA and found sobriety. Then I got into Al-Anon, and I found me. And a year and a half ago, I weighed 209, and I got into OA, another 12-step program. You know what these damn programs keep telling me? That I am powerless! Powerless! Woo! I hate that word. And I keep getting freer and freer, and more of me comes up. It's wonderful. If I make it till October 4th, it'll be a year without a cigarette. And I'm telling you, I know everyone who's holding the cool in here today. I am powerless. But I have hopes today and dreams today, and I have a life that I would never give up for the first one of any of those substances again. And I'm real grateful to y'all for being here, because you're what makes it happen. Thanks.